Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme.
Well, Giles, here we are, another week, another episode, another thing that we're trying to remember is good for us. I hope you've been practicing all the other ones. The theme on this week's show is the importance of play and imagination for our well-being. And our incredible guest this week is Chris Barlow.
An experienced designer, builder of puppets, sets, props and creatures for TV, film and theatre. He's also an illustrator and a sculptor. His work has been seen on many big productions, including shows that are on Netflix, Lucasfilm, and of course the BBC. Yeah, my first question was, what's your first experience of puppeteering? Was it the classic Punch and Judy show, or was there some other sort of performance or show that you went to see that it first inspired you to get into this career?
I don't know exactly which one came first, because I have very foggy memories of my early childhood, but there were probably three or four moments in my childhood that led me to kind of puppets and creatures and things. And one of them was actually my school as a kid did a like World Puppetry Week.
Oh, wow.
When we were young. And they just like had theatre companies and puppet companies come in and do shows. And I remember, I have distinct memories of like making a puppet out of a paper plate with one of these companies and then doing a show. And then a company came in and did a string, like a marionette show about Hansel and Gretel. And it blew my mind. And to this day, I'm still not sure how they pulled the witch into the oven without getting all the strings caught. Like, it's still like, I never solved it. So that was a really distinctive time. My grandparents once brought me back a puppet, I think he was called Sanchez, like a little string puppet that they got on a marketplace in Spain when I was about four or five. And I think I was into marionettes at first. And I think it was the magic of something looking alive, even though it was clearly an inanimate object. There was something really magical about that, and the fact that you can control it and sort of make it do things was just something that it just grabbed me. And then that kind of mixed with a deep things like The Labyrinth, which I watched.
I was going to mention The Labyrinth,
watching it on and then Gremlins as well. I watched the first half of Gremlins up until they turned nasty, where it terrified me. Way too young.
Oh, same here. I was far too young to watching Gremlins.
Far too young, like 4 or 5 years old. And then later, a little bit later on, Jurassic Park. And it was those seeing those characters on screen that you knew you knew deep down didn't exist. They weren't real, but also they weren't CGI, and you just knew they were in the world. And the fact that I knew they were out there in the world just sort of made it really magical for me. And I just had to sort of understand it and work out how is this possible? Who did this? Like, why is it obsessed with me? Why have I got this kind of need to know that these things exist and that you can make them move and live and they have character? And yeah, so I'm so sorry. That was a rambling, nonsensical answer.
I want to ask you if you've still got that paper plate puppet, the marionettes. Have you still got those?
I have no idea where that paper plate puppet went, but I do have that marionette. That is in a storage box in the roof at the moment where I've not long moved house. But yes, I have it. I have him and a little wooden Pinocchio string puppet that the same grandparents bought me back from, I think, Italy, like 2 years afterwards, because I'd loved the other one so much.
And I want to ask you, can you sing a song from The Labyrinth? Because I can.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Which one? Can we just start at the top?
Just start at the top. All of them, all of them.
All of them.
I loved Labyrinth. I had it on VHS video, and I watched it over and over and over again. I've got it on DVD now. I watch it every like
now.
Sorry, I'm not.
It is
that
on Netflix. Yeah, you can watch it on Netflix. Other streaming versions.
It's one of my favorite things. And the reason it's one of my favorite things is not just because of the puppets, which I'm also fascinated by. Because I remember in my CDT class at school, we had to kind of make something out of wood, and I made a wooden marionette with like a Harlequin with like diamonds and with like a little eye mask and stuff. And I was obsessed. We kind of put little clips in to make the joints move. And so I love it for the puppetry, but I also love Labyrinth because it used puppets to tell the story of this girl who was trying to find her way, trying to find her power and her authority, and trying to kind of work out her way in the world. And all the little creatures that she met on her journey, just basically a bit like what we all go through in life, but represented on screen with like amazing songs and David Bowie in tights.
And everyone has a childhood memory of David Bowie's tights. It's such a joyous film that looks at kids playing child that's on the precipice of becoming an adult who's still make-believing, playing, and still going through storytelling and living her fantasies. And it's a real embodiment of that. And it has a moral tale, which is, I think, which is part of play, isn't it? That's how, I think, you know, that's how you learn, morals, and what your wants and your desires and what you're thinking about.
Well, it's about kind of like you say.
Very much about that.
It's about storytelling, allowing us to express our own feelings and fears. But also, whenever I watch anything on TV or I listen to something, if I can see a bit of myself in that character on that journey, for myself, like when I've had tough times in life, I actually imagine that I am that character. Like, I'll have my earphones in on the train and I'll kind of just put myself into that world of like, yeah, I'm that character. I'm going through their challenge in terms of that song that I'm hearing or whatever they're talking about. And if they can do it, oh, I can do it too. So I frequently imagine myself to be Sarah from The Labyrinth, who's going along her journey.
I know exactly what you mean.
Which one were you, Giles?
Well, I was just trying to avoid the bog of eternal stench constantly.
Oh my God, yes.
That was always my biggest fear, was like ending up there. Like, it's the sort of thing I now sort of say to my children: if you mess around, don't go to bed on time. It's the bog of eternal stench for you.
That was also a reference my brother used to kind of give me when I was about to go to the toilet. Or he was like,
yeah,
he was like, are you in the bog of eternal stench? I was like, go away, shut up.
But it's interesting because it feels like at that time, and I guess in the 80s as well, it obviously became very popular, that kind of storytelling. And we kind of moved away about, I guess, technology kind of took over, and you go into the 90s and the noughties, it was more using CGI and stuff. But it feels like there's been a renaissance for that. Do you feel that's been true of recent years?
Yeah, hugely. I think I think there was like puppets were everywhere because it was the only way to do it, you know, for a lot of especially fantasy stuff and kids telly. And then along came this explosion of computer technology, and everyone decided suddenly that's the answer because there's less restrictions. Every puppet, like Hoggle or a Gremlin, or it's an entourage of people, and you can't always get the angle that you may want because you've got all the cables, or you've got battery packs, or you've got other people under the floor. So I think suddenly everyone was like, yeah, we can do whatever we want with computers. But I actually think there were so many open opportunities that it stopped people thinking as creatively. When you are restricted, you really hone in on the character and the story and the shots that matter and how to portray those things as eloquently and as honestly as possible. And then I think when you're trying to film something that doesn't exist and isn't there and could do anything you potentially could ever want it to do, that kind of craft of really focusing in kind of disappeared a while. It became all about, and I think people realize actually there's just something really charming about real things being there on camera. You get a different performance from the actors. You get a different feel. Even, you know, the cinematographers, everyone looks at them differently because they can see the light hitting the fur, and they can see how the face looks on screen. And it just brings something else on set. It just, when I think about feeling better, and like, do you remember we had the school kids come in, and there was that one girl who just loved Ben, like poor Colin, trying to kick. She was grabbing him and throwing herself on him and holding him and hugging him tight, and she just loved him. Now, if that was a tennis ball on a stick, I don't think she'd have the same experience. Maybe she would.
So this was a series that you and I worked on together for CBeebies, which is called Feeling Better, which was out now in 2018. It was out, and it was very much, it was a series all about emotional intelligence, I suppose, emotional awareness for preschool children. So it had 26 episodes. Every episode did a different emotion. I got to live in a house with these two incredible puppets that you, Chris, designed, created, made, maintained, looked after. And it was an incredible... that's how we met. That's how we met. And actually, that series for me was literally everything about me that I love, all wrapped up in one bundle. It was, you know, mental health, emotional well-being, creativity, fun, skill, meeting people like you and understanding like how your craft works, how skilled you are. And obviously Colin and Claire, who were the puppeteers, who were just incredible. And even when, so back in the day when I was watching Labyrinth or whatever else it might have been, I always thought, wow, that's so, once I understood that people were making these puppets, I was like, wow, that's so clever. How skillful, how amazing. I wonder how they do it. I'd love to go and find out and to see behind the scenes, because I think for me, that's a real attraction about anything to do with puppets. Like, how do you do that? And when I did Feeling Better with you and saw Colin and Claire with these puppets and how they worked and like how you maneuvered your body, their bodies under like sofas and like all these random places, and how the eyes worked and the, you know, the legs worked, I was like, oh my God, this is incredible. So for me, I watched The Dark Crystal recently when it was out, and I loved it because I was just sitting there thinking, this is so clever. This must have taken ages of work, time, imagination. Like, I saw it as a huge achievement of a huge group of people. And that attracts me to puppeteering and to puppetry because of the immense craft and skill that's involved.
And there is so much craft. And I think that's also part of the appeal, that I think that's what it engaged me as a kid with it as well, especially when like Jurassic Park came out, and it was a real pinnacle. Those dinosaurs by the Stan Winston company were a real, like, the best of the best, and they stand the test of time now. They're beautiful designs and beautiful paintwork and amazing animatronics, and just that kind of knowledge that they existed made them even more magical. Like, who were these people who designed it? Who sculpted it? How did they get from that sketch to on screen and look so amazing? And that's like, it's a bit like knowing how magic works. Sometimes knowing how the trick works makes it even more interesting because it's so clever, and getting it, doing it really well has so much skill that it sort of adds layers of magic.
100%. And I by the end of that series, I wanted to be a puppeteer, and I wanted to come and live in your studio where you're creating all these incredible creatures, and just come in there at night and be like, wow.
It's very cold. There's a lot of squirrels.
And I obviously some of your pictures or your sculptures of sort of heads of creatures and arms and how the mechanics work. So I'd be like, oh my God, I'd love to go and just like explore. It's like a magical cave that you could just go in and just be like, wow, what is this hand doing over here? What's this eye doing? What's going on?
What is this? Oh no, that's my body's room. It's what I found really exciting. I'm an easily excited person. but what's been constantly like blows my mind is, now I'm working with people whose work blew my mind as a kid. There's a sculptor called Gary Pollard who I met through a company called Millennium Effects. And he's like, most of the things I watched as a kid that I loved, he has sculpted. Like Audrey 2 from The Little Shop of Horrors, he was one of the core sculptors on it.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know this when I started working with him. But when I found it out, I mean, I just couldn't ever really speak to him ever again. I was so starstruck having already known him. Yeah, it's so strange. And people that I've worked with that are friends, and they'll kind of say, oh yeah, well, when I was doing, making the White Lion in Jim Henson's The Storyteller, and then poof, my brain's gone again, because I remember that and it blew me away as a kid. So it's really exciting to be fortunate enough to be meeting these people. And I still find the magic in it. When I've been working on creature effects and I've been part of that build team, I still find like it's so exciting at the end, seeing it come together and come to life. Like I still get that weird childlike, oh my God, this is so cool. But I obviously on set, I'm like, yeah, yeah, sure. I'm really off the set, don't worry.
I mean, that's nothing. That's nothing. You should see what else I can do. That's like nothing. It's fine.
That's nothing. Yeah, whatever. Cool. Yeah, sure.
Well, I think sorry, Chris. I was just going to say that's wonderful that you, because I think often with creativity, sometimes it just becomes a job, doesn't it? Like, you know, and to be able to retain that love and enjoyment and enthusiasm for something is really wonderful to hear.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Like, I just love it. And I love seeing, I love working with people and creative people, and I love seeing them do well and seeing their work come to life. And when it comes to things like the big creature effect stuff, the work I've done in that, I'm just a small cog in that wheel, because those kinds of creatures take a small army. You know, you've got your mold making department, you've got your sculptors, you've got your mechs people, you've got your fabrication team, and somehow you all come together and to complete this amazing creature. And it's just really exciting. And there's that point where it does start coming together, and you're closing up the seams and the first layers of paint go on, and then the glossing goes on, and it is magical. And
that's
still
so exciting. You're making me excited just by you talking about sewing things up and painting things. I'm like, yeah. What's mechs? Who are the mechs people?
So mechanical components. Oh, so, you know, like all the, okay. The motors or the cables that move, or the paddles that make the faces move and the heads, eye blinks and mouth, wow. And all the vowel sounds and the programming of it. And it's just brilliant. You know, I'm sat here making more kind of Muppety things, but like when I get to do those big team projects, it's really exciting. I mean, not every job's a joy. Let's be real.
I mean, working with Rada, for example. Jobs,
I wish would just go away.
Working with Rada and hearing Rada sing was not very pleasant for you. That was the scariest moment of my entire life, but I took it on anyway, because I was like, if I don't do it, I'll regret it. I'm just going to have a go, open my mouth and see what comes out, and forget everyone's ears in the studio. They won't mind as well.
And it's amazing what they can do with auto-tune these days as well.
Exactly, exactly.
It's amazing. And, it was only going to be shown nationally and in Sweden now and Finland or somewhere and forever on YouTube.
You know me, Chris. I always have to have a go. I mean, what can go wrong?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I was going to say, Chris, it sounds like, you know, being a puppeteer is so many, it encompasses so many different things. You know, you're creating the characters, you're performing, you're a mechanical engineer, it sounds like, at some points. What's the thing that really gives you the most joy in that process?
I like doing... You know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, and Slarty Bartfast says, I like doing the coastal bits. I'm a bit like that. Like, I quite like doing the fluffy, like, oh, let's do a little dab of paint here, and like the dressing and bringing the character out. That's kind of my favourite bit. That's the finishing. The colouring in, yeah. I love the start of a project when... You're working out what you've got to do. You're working on the designs, and there's the process of how do we get this design into a 3D physical actual thing. That starting process is really fun, and there's patterning and there's the fabrication and working like so fabrication's kind of soft mechanics. It's how do you make spongy things move, and all of that's fun. And then there's a middle bit that I always hate. Which is just like, oh, that's not working. Oh, that failed. Oh, I've got to cut that off. Oh, I need to make new ones of those. And that bit's gross. And then like we're near the end.
Reminds me
like,
of kind of tidying your room when you kind of get to that point where you clear everything out, and then you're really enthusiastic about clearing up your room, and then halfway through you kind of see this huge pile of stuff in your room. You're like, oh my god, what have I done? I can't get it all finished by the end of the day.
Yeah,
and then slowly it comes together.
Shoving it back into the cupboards. Exactly. And it's just as bad as it was before, but in different places.
Yeah.
It's I love that kind of getting over the finish line, the finishing details, polishing the eyes, trimming the hair, painting the skin. Like it's really satisfying. Painting is such a joy because suddenly it just goes ping, and you've got this amazing like character. Which before was all bland, you know, it was all maybe one colour or it didn't have a skin. And suddenly you get all the kind of details and it all sorts to suddenly live. And I love that. That's my favourite bit.
But normally by that
point, I'm sick of the job and I want it gone. And then after the job's done, I'm then like, oh, I missed that job.
I want to ask you, Chris, have any of your puppets come to life at night?
They all do. Ben and Bria are like banging in their box going, let us out.
Now I ask that because I've got a big imagination, you have too, and Giles has too, because Giles is really creative. He writes stories, he authors things, all kinds of stuff. But I know that some people do struggle with imagination, and I think it's something which it's a funny thing, imagination, because it's something which obviously we're all kind of born with and we're really open to when we're little. You know, we learn with stories, we get creative, we love kind of making things, and we love kind of just making our minds open to whatever there is. But I think obviously as we get older, society kind of tells us we should squash those things out, we should get rid of them, we should be adults, we should grow up, which I absolutely hate that phrase so much. And I think for some of us, like, we try to retain some of that childlike imagination, but for some other people they find it really difficult to imagine, to be open to that as they get older and kind of life gets in the way. Have you found that, or have you come across people who just look at you and go, what are you doing? Like, you're making these creatures. Oh. What's that about?
Yeah, I think it's funny. I think age makes a difference. When I was in my 20s and I was telling people I did this, so like, say I'd go on a date, people would just sort of make slightly snarky comments or be a bit disrespectful because they didn't see it as a serious job. You know, oh, you're not really working then. You're not really committing to society, and you're not putting in. I was like, why?
Wow.
Like, because they saw it as a frivolous thing. Like, oh, that's not going to last. It's, you know, a lot of parents would tell their kids, don't act, don't be an artist, don't do this, because they're difficult jobs, to be fair. You know, they are hard work to make a living from. And so, but then you reach like 30 and then you start getting closer to 40 and suddenly people are like, oh, you must be very serious. And now that's interesting. How did you manage to survive to 40 doing something so ridiculous? And suddenly they're interested. So that's weird. Like in my 20s, that wasn't respected, but it is now. And I think, but I think that plays into that societal attitude of you're supposed to do certain things and there aren't these other things that other people want to do, like design and puppet making stuff. You know, that's frivolous and stupid. And, you know, you're chasing a dream. And I don't know why we're very anti that. It's not to say it's not to say it's wrong, because as I would probably have to have, you know, if I had a child, I would probably feel the responsibility to say, you know, it's really difficult, because the creative arts is a difficult world. It's very competitive and it's a lot of people want to do it. So I understand the thought behind it, but I think you're right. It's a bigger thing in society of grow up, don't play. Mm-hmm. Every child draws. I think drawing is quite a common thing that people lose. You know, if you're a good doodler, everyone's quite impressed if you can put a pencil to paper and kind of go, oh, that does look like so-and-so. Well, that's a lovely picture. And they go, well, I can't draw a stick man. So, but you did, as a kid you did, and you weren't scared to. At some point you've gone, I'm scared of failing at this. I'm scared to pursue this. I'm scared to keep doing this because it will be seen and judged. So people get afraid of it.
And I think it's because play is kind of viewed as immature. So whenever I go to any kind of place with my nieces or nephews, they have the best time because they have all these like soft play areas and they have all these games and activities. And I feel really jealous of them. Yeah, so do I. I feel so jealous of them because I'm like, I want to have a go at that. So Chris, you were saying something like, you were saying not everyone is able to do that. Some people really fear ...
Yeah. So not everyone is able to stand by their creative and playful wants, I suppose, desires, because I think we get instilled with fear. We get scared of, I mean, as a kid, people, you know, you get called names, you get bullied, you get called, you know, gay or whatever. And, you know, yes, I was, so maybe they were right. But the, you know, there is always a fear of backlash for something, for sticking a head above the parapet, for standing out or standing up for yourself. There's a fear of backlash. And that might not be your friends. It might not be people in the school. It might not be your teachers, but it might be your parents. It might be grandparents. It might be aunts, uncles. You know, you just don't know, but you just get this, the pressure to have to find something that you can make money at and not necessarily be good at or not necessarily be passionate about. And we spend so much of our life in work that I'm a passionate advocate for people to pursue something that they at least enjoy or have an interest in. And if they don't, then change it. You know, that doesn't mean you have to be out of work. I think it's very easy to be blasé and be like, oh yeah, darling, just go do it. That's not reality. People have bills to pay and they have responsibilities. But if you can find a way to pay your bills and still find something that speaks to your soul, then do it. And maybe that's not work. Maybe it's finishing work and going to a life drawing class. Or maybe it's just going to the cinema and going every day if you want to. Whatever that is, I just think it's really important. Life is too short.
It really is. And with your own story, there are like two really huge things that you brought up there, which I think for us to highlight would actually help society actually reframe the importance of creativity and give creativity and the arts the attention it deserves. One is obviously how creativity probably helped you process that trauma of losing your mum at a young age. And, you know, we know that creativity and storytelling and play therapy can really help people process trauma and actually kind of work through issues and work through problems. And but also the second aspect is creativity and its role in self-expression, you know, how we can express who we are, not just through words or through, you know, speaking out loud, but through play or creating or all kind. I mean, creativity, I think when you say the arts or creativity, people jump to this natural idea of what that looks like, you know, whether it's the Royal Opera House or it's writing a novel.
Yeah, you think Arts Council.
Yeah, number one in the world or whatever it is. But creativity is anything. Creativity is going out in the garden and planting a plant or, you know, singing a song in your bathroom or
creativity.
Yeah, or it kind of if it floats your boat, you know, creating a spreadsheet on your computer. You know, there's so many things which are creative. And I think sometimes we block off, we kind of divide, you know, science from arts. So, you know, me being a doctor, for example, I love imagination. I love being creative. I love playing. I love doing all kinds of things that are different. And yet I found in my medical career, when I would mention sometimes in my broadcasting work, people would be like, what are you doing? That's really weird. Why don't you settle down and just get a normal kind of work profile in your week? And for a while, for about 3 or 4 years, I thought, well, maybe there is something wrong with me. Maybe I should do what all these other people are doing because they all seem to be doing it and they all seem to be telling me that I'm weird and I'm strange. But then actually, as I've got older and I've just done more stuff and I've listened, like you said, Chris, listened to my heart to be like, actually, this is who I am. This is what I love. This is what makes, this gives me energy. Then I've slowly come to realize that actually, you know, yes, listen to other people, but don't absorb it and don't do what everyone else is doing, because the science and arts, people are whole beings. They're not just one aspect, one identity. And I think if we have one identity only in our lives, whether or not that's a job or a relationship, we're going to be in trouble, because when that identity falls apart, which it probably will at some point, we're basically going to be left with nothing.
I think that's a really important point. I think, you know, the last 2 years has really shown how workplaces can change, how jobs can disappear. And I think if a lot of your identity is placed into your singular role in your job, because that's how you've grown up and developed your working life because of how you've been told to do it or the pressures you felt to do that, what happens to you when that stops? Or what happens to you when it becomes too much and you don't have something else that feeds you? And I think, you know, I would urge anyone to don't be afraid of play, you know, whatever that is. Don't be afraid of doing the pub quiz with your mates or getting singing lessons. Even if you never want to sing in front of other people, you just want, just because you love music and you want to have that, you want to set that time for yourself to enjoy songs that you can caterwaul in somebody else's house and just enjoy it. Doodling, pick up a pen and, you know, pen and paper, or get a little notebook, and rather than go out for a cigarette break, take 5 minutes and do a doodle, or write down jokes or little stories or a diary, anything. It's amazing what you might find you enjoy that you forgot you ever liked. It doesn't matter what you think is good or not good. Doesn't even really matter. It's the process. And I think it offers a lot. Like, I think comedy can deal with how you feel quite a lot. Sometimes it's very difficult to say how you feel, but it's a lot easier to make jokes about it. And so, you know, that's not always the best way to deal with things, but that can be a starting point of a discussion.
Mm.
It's hard. Like, life can be really difficult, really draining and really punishing. And I think it's a shame that people can sometimes suffer because they've lost the things that they love, because they've felt the pressure of their job or their bills or their societal situation. When there's so much out there you can do. But people are scared to fail or scared to be thought of differently.
Mm.
And life is short. Life is so short. You just don't know what's around the corner.
That's so true, isn't it? And Giles is nodding away because obviously Giles is an author. And Giles, you know, obviously in some of your books, you've wrote about really sort of personal things that happened to you. And I think writing probably helps you sort of to process things. I mean, it helps all of us, I think, even if we're not aware of it. And I think sometimes when people say go and write something, you know, people imagine, oh, I need to go and have this nice desk with loads of books around me, and I need to kind of write some kind of, you know, yeah, get the perfect sentence right off the bat from you know, sort of second zero. But that's not really writing, is it? I mean, Giles, you'll know more about writing than I do, but
well, you've published all for now. I always say to people to have, you know, anybody that sort of expresses an interest in writing and wants to know more about it, I say, oh, just have a notepad next, like, with you at all times. You know, I think most creative people should have a notepad with them that they can just jot down anything. Like, it might just be a word, but anything that you can reflect back to. I mean, going back to your point, losing your mum at an early age, I lost my mum at an early age, and it certainly was something, a catalyst for me, I think, going on further to sort of pursue creative things. And it was an outlet for me, you know, like I started learning the guitar, and music was a big part of my life, and that was a real outlet for me. And it was very comforting to dive into the creative fields for me, and to be able to express myself through those things. So I totally empathise with you on that, and I'm very sorry that you lost your mum at such an early age. But yeah, I totally understood that, what you were saying there. And yeah, it's always been a great comfort for me in any difficult times I'm going through in life, to be able to sort of really hone into my creative work, as being, you know, such a comforting thing to fall back on.
It really is. And I don't know if you found this, Giles, because you just mentioned you lost your mum at early age as well. Whether I found that gave me a really strange sense of mortality. Mm-hmm. So my mum was 42 when she died.
Mine was 43.
Really?
Yeah.
Gosh. Yeah. And that, now that I am closing in on 39, 28.
25, Chris.
I've 25 again. I've realized how young that is.
Yeah.
And I've always had this slightly strange feeling of I might not get past that.
Absolutely.
Because she didn't.
Yeah.
And so, like, I only have this much time. I have this very small amount of time, and I really, really, really want to do all these different things. So it sort of gave me a little bit of a kick up the arse. If there is a gift from losing a parent at a young age, for me, it was trying not to waste time.
Yeah.
And just sodding the consequences and just going after things that you love and dream, just in case. At least you tried.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's something I've talked to a few people about, actually. I talked to the actor Stephen Mangan about this. He lost his mum at an early age, and he said he wouldn't have gone into acting probably if his mum hadn't passed away, because it fueled him to keep going and taking risks, because he thought, do you know what? My mum was 40, like similar to age to our mums, and she passed away. He said, I'm going to probably die at 40 as well. You know, he had that mentality about it. So I'm just going to go for
it. So strange.
It's a funny thing. Yeah. It sets a clock going almost, you know. And I'm at, you know, I've passed the age my mum was when she died. I'm 44 now. And yeah, and it's obviously I'm still here, thankfully. But yeah, but it's still kind of there. You know, you still want to take, you know, you still will take risks. And I will still take risks because, you know, because I know that that clock is ticking.
Yeah, it is crazy. Just a few years ago, my best friend died, and he was in his mid-30s. That feeling, I think when you're young, you can feel like you're immortal.
Absolutely.
And it's very hard to understand how short life can be and how quickly it disappears. And actually, when you're faced with death when you're younger, I think it can give you a gift of, wow, life is short and life is fragile. So live it.
Yeah.
You know, don't waste it. Every you know, every evening not feeling great about your job is almost a day missed. Mm. You know, it's a day it you probably could be sat feeling really good about something you've done or enjoyed.
Mm. And maybe also losses of different kinds also inspire people to be more determined to go looking for the joy in life as well, because you've experienced so much pain and distress and, you know, challenging times. I think sometimes that can, after you've processed that, it can flip it on its head and almost be like, well, actually, do you know what? I'm going to go and find some joy now. I'm going to seek it. I'm going to actively seek out joy and happiness in little moments, in being creative, in doing whatever I want to do, because I've experienced the opposite and I want some joy to refill myself up with.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, that I think, you know, that can almost be obsessive, I would say, you know, running away from those dark things. I definitely think it feels great to do things that at least think that kind of bring joy, or I like the idea of putting things out in the world that might last past me. You know, if I do only have 3 years left, well, you know, maybe in 25 years time, someone else might pick up a puppet I made or see something I worked on. And, you know, I've made some kind of difference or mark in some way.
That reminds me of a lovely Sia track. I love her music, but I think it's called Courage to Change. And there's a lovely lyric in that song which says, I want my life to matter. And it's a beautiful, beautiful song. If you haven't heard it, go and listen to it, because it's a really inspiring song. And it makes you think all about life and about what you're here to do and why you're here to do it and what your kind of purpose might be. And it just reminds me of that. Yeah, if you need a pick-me-up, I listen to that and I sing it in my car really loudly. Can't be a bit of Sia.
Well, you should hear me sing a chandelier.
yeah, well, I mean, I've tried chandelier, but the notes are too high for me, but who cares anyway, does it?
But that really reminds me, it's a beautiful quote by the author Chuck Palahniuk. He said something like, I don't want to live forever, but I want to make stuff that will. Which, you know, I totally agree with you on that thing. I mean, I desperately want, you know, to create stuff that, you know, outlive me and that other generations of people will enjoy at some point in their lives.
And we can imagine what that might look like as well. I think imagination is so, it's like the kind of relative who's stuck in the corner, you know, the difficult uncle from a Christmas dinner who's stuck in the corner and everyone's just a bit like, oh, just ignore that. Just ignore imagination. Like, it's fine. He'll go home soon. It'll be fine. He's a bit embarrassing. But imagine, I write about this sometimes in newspapers, but one of the things I'm really passionate about is talking about how imagination is actually a practical tool for well-being. It's not just a word. It's not just, you know, something you see if you're watching a film for the afternoon. It's like a thing which can help us problem solve. It can help find solutions. It can help us express ourselves. Like, imagination, it kind of brings in mindfulness as well, doesn't it? And meditation, to get away from challenging thoughts and feelings. So imagination is actually like a daily tool that you can use to feel better, not just something for primary school children.
No, it's not just like, oh, trolls and dragons and fantasy stories. Thinking about what you're going to do for dinner is imagination. Mm-hmm. Working out, daydreaming, thinking about scenarios that might happen at work is imagination.
Going to your happy place. Tool. You know that phrase, go to a happy place in your mind. Yes. Go to a happy place is imagination. You know, when you sit there, you close your eyes, you imagine yourself on a beach. I've done this frequently, by the way. Imagine yourself on a beach.
You're always on a beach, the sounds,
always on a beach, always, yeah, on a lilo on a beach. the sound of the waves, the sun on your face, the sand, or, you know, using your senses to take you to your happy place or your safe place. That is, for me, during the pandemic, those kind of techniques were so useful for me to just get away from all of the noise, all of the challenge, all of the difficulties that have been going on for the last sort of 2 years or so. Like, my imagination really saved me during some really tough times through the pandemic. Yeah.
I wonder if people struggle to know what their happy place is. I have a good imagination and it's something I thrive off of, but I would probably argue that I could probably do more for myself in terms of knowing what my mental happy place is. And that's something I could probably work on. I wouldn't be able to close my eyes now and know what my happy place is. Mm-hmm. That would be a struggle. But then that's because I'm an overthinker. So I will start going, it's warm and I'm on the beach and oh my God, I forgot to do that. And that's going to happen. And then if I do that wrong, they're going to be really angry and I didn't send their email.
So Chris is on this lilo, but he's like getting all these
drowning.
Things about. drowning your lilo.
There's someone's a tsunami.
Someone's kind of swum up underneath your lilo, punctured it. And you're like, no. But you're right. But I think that's a really great thing to say, because I mean, I also, you know, I think we all have to work at that. I have to work at that as well, because I've got a very active mind. And I think that if we all just sort of sat down for a little while and said, all right, well, where do I feel comforted? Where do I feel safe? Where do I feel happy? What does that look like? You know, not just in our imaginations, but then using that once we get it in our imagination to bring it into our daily lives. Say, okay, well, if that's what I can imagine or I can kind of think of as my safe place, how can I then create that safety around me now, here, where I am? So that no matter where you are, what you're doing, what's going on for you, what challenges you have, you've got that safe place inside you. It's not out there, it's in here, in your mind. So you're never without it. And that, I think, really builds a sense of trust in your own ability to help yourself feel better and to kind of cope with life. So I think it's a really, it's a gift. And I think I haven't worked on it enough. I don't think any of us probably have, but I think it's a really great thing to start to think about and to kind of cultivate.
Yeah, and just the making the effort to find that process in itself, I think would be a healthy exercise. You know, and recognizing those moments when you do feel warm and secure and happy or content or just calm, and remembering that moment, and then that can become part of your happy place. You know, where were you? What was that moment that gave you those 5 minutes of peace? Mm-hmm. And that's all of that is imagination.
Sorry, there's a lag. Go on, you go first. Go on.
You go. I'm just rambling on.
No, go on.
I was going to say wasn't there some study on people who daydream a lot handle scenarios better because they've sort of imagined the outcomes. So when these, you know, when the electricity goes and the house floods, they sort of handle it better because they've gone, oh my God, what if the house floods?
You're right. There are eight different types of imagination. And one of those is exactly as you say, that ability to sort of, if you like, problem solve or look at strategies for things that might come up and being able to be adaptable to different scenarios. So there are kind of eight different types of ways we can imagine. And they're really useful for like everyday life. it's not just like a couple of minutes away from if you're a bit bored, it's actually sort of useful stuff that our brains start to form and kind of, like you say, being more adaptable, being more flexible with challenge and be more open to the possibility of things getting better. You know, yeah. I think hope is very much related to imagination, that when you're going through a difficult time and you can't see how anything could ever get better, your imagination is there to help you find hope again, that something could, you know, get better. There is
visualize
a possibility
where you want to be what could be out there for you.
Exactly. Very, very much linked, I think, to hope. So it's so, imagination is just kind of everything. I was going to ask you, for people who find it hard to imagine, or they haven't used their imagination for a long time because it's been squeezed out like this kind of lemon that's now all kind of just sucked dry of juice through society, through the world and through what they've been told, how would you encourage them? What would you say to them to sort of start using their imagination or to kind of get more used to being comfortable with it anyway?
I'd probably say try and relate it to what they do anyway. I think people don't realize when they're using their imagination. So if they're at work and they're thinking, what can we have for dinner? They're using their imagination. They're starting to visualize what they have in the fridge, what they could get on the shop, what the journey home. So I think if you can encourage people to recognize that they already use their imagination for a lot of things, that, you know, will maybe think about not what you could have for dinner with what you've got, but start imagining what you'd like to have. And, you know, maybe you'd like some really fancy kind of dessert, and what is that? And just don't be afraid to think a bit further. It's, you know, start where you're comfortable and think a bit further. You know you're comfortable at home maybe, but what would you like in your home that would make it even better? And start imagining the space, and that can lead to aspirational things, I think. And, you know, what sort of stuff, if you're unhappy with something, think about what might make you happy. And then again, that's imagination. And then you can start thinking about how to make that happen. What are the different stepping stones to that to happen? And what if you went around this way? Or what if you thought about doing it another way? And again, it's using your imagination within the confines of what you're comfortable with. And just, I think the more you start to do that, the more you realize you'll use it and can use it for the better for yourself, I think.
That's wonderful advice.
I don't know.
No, that it's brilliant. No,
rubbish.
Absolutely not. No, I think small steps is always a good place to start. We've talked a lot about joy today, and it's been an absolute joy to talk to you. I've really, really enjoyed our conversation. And
thank you so much. Like, what an honour. Like, this is lovely.
The honour is all ours. So thank you so much for being a guest.
It's true.
On the podcast.
I told you, didn't I, Giles, that Chris would just be amazing.
Yeah.
not just because of all his skills and the fact that he's just a lovely, lovely person, but also he put up with my singing and he said it was good when I was on the CBeebies show.
I love your singing.
It's kind of him to lie, wasn't it?
Those YouTube songs have like 4,000 views and that's all me. No one else watched it. I did.
I'm now going to send you voice notes every single day with a snippet of me singing.
What,
Chris,
Sia? Just
because
Sia,
you said that. Yeah, a bit of Sia, a bit of Chandelier, kind of at 1 o'clock
in
the morning.
Oh my God, we should go to karaoke.
I love karaoke. I'm a karaoke diva though. I steal the microphone. I hog the microphone.
Oh,
I literally will take
it. You're a demon in the corner.
Go into the
toilet
and like not let anyone else in.
Oh, sorry, is the door locked? I don't know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
We'll just have to wait outside. I've got three more.
Near the bog of eternal stench, yeah. Thank you so much, Chris. As Giles said, you've been absolutely fantastic. You really have. Thank you so much. Keep being amazing out in the world. Keep doing things which will last well beyond any of us being here one day. You're definitely creating a legacy.
I hope so, in some form. Or a leg, just a leg.
So that's the end of another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Forgot Podcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.